This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Global warming acceleration.
This is Radio EcoShock, the weekly science-based program broadcast by 104 nonprofit radio stations in the United States, Canada, the UK, France, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith. 2020 will be the hottest year ever recorded, and the rate of global warming accelerated in the past 6 or 7 years. That is the latest word from the scientist who warned Congress about global warming in 1988. On December 14, 2020, Dr. James Hansen, former NASA Goddard Space Institute director, released a new post called Global Warming Acceleration. The co-author is Dr. Makiko Sato from Columbia Earth Institute. Their explanation for the rapid burst of warming we've just gone through may surprise you. The climate shift is speeding up. No wonder the United Nations just called for a wide-ranging declaration of climate emergency from every government, even while the pandemic rages in many countries. We are going to explore a bit of basic climate science to understand why more heat waves, wildfires, and violent weather are striking around the world. We know how difficult 2020 has been in health, in the economy, in politics, and while we were busy with all that, Earth experienced several of the hottest months ever recorded for May, June, September, and November this year. It will be, Hanso and Sato say, the hottest year ever seen. But it gets more shocking. This could have been a cooler year. It should have been. The great cooling phenomenon called La Niña was strong in 2020. The sun's power was at minimum levels as part of the solar cycle. Western economies closed down at times, and human emissions were measurably lower than in previous years. A slowdown in planetary warming, but the opposite happened. We must find out why, before the strong solar cycle returns, along with the El Niño events that previously set world heat records, like the one in 1997 and 98. If our fossil fuel burning goes back to normal, when any of those natural forces develop, we could be in for a severe climate shock as early as 2025. Earth has warmed more and more over the last 20 years. If 2020 is the hottest, 2016 was the second, 2019 third, followed by 2017, 2015, and 2018. It's all just happened. Every year in the past 5 years has been hotter than anything before. We are not talking about just the Arctic, which was astronomically hotter than anything ever seen during the times of humans. This was the whole world record, a global temperature. That sounds like trouble, and it has been hard for everyone escaping massive wildfires or trying to recover from the back-to-back mega storms that I covered on Radio EcoShock in my show posted November 25th, 2020. You can find that at ecoshock.org, and it's well worth getting it. But that is just a start. We are at the beginning with many more waves of heat, violent weather, and agricultural failure. That's food we're talking about here, people. And it's all coming this decade and every decade for at least the next hundreds of years. By changing the atmosphere and trapping heat, scientists discovered only about 4% of our actual impact goes into warming the atmosphere directly. The rest of the new energy that we create mostly goes into the ocean. That harms the existing marine biosphere. It's killing so many species, from plankton to coral to the largest marine mammals. The continual heating of the seas has saved humanity from the true force of solar captured energy. But that heat will come back out, warming the planet for centuries, no matter what we do. We are committed to strong climate change. The big questions are, how bad will it be? How fast is it arriving? And can we slow down or reverse the warming? And finally, can we survive? As we dig into this alarming announcement from top climate scientists, I owe you a couple of cautions. First of all, I am not a climate scientist. Over the past 15 years, some of the world's best climate scientists have schooled me with their interviews, and I make detailed notes, and I ask some of the dumb questions we all want to know. If I make mistakes, please let me know in my blog comments, an email, or you can contact me at ecoshock.org. Second, Not everyone in the world science community agrees with James Hansen, even though he is a legendary scholar and a pioneer in climate change. This new article appears to be a blog post at this time rather than a peer-reviewed paper. Hansen and Sato offer criticisms of some climate modelers and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And here, Hansen's answer as to why the temperature is spiking so high is, I would say, a theory still more open to testing. But these two are teachers who are reaching out beyond the science community to us, ready to speak to the rest of the people, and they must, because there is so little time to avoid disaster, and it will take all humanity to fix it if we can. Here are the first two paragraphs of this December 2020 post by Hansen and Sato. November 2020 was the warmest November in the period of instrumental data, thus jumping 2020 and ahead of 2016 in the 11-month averages. December 2016 was relatively cool, so it is clear that 2020 will slightly edge 2016 for the warmest year, at least in our analysis. The rate of global warming accelerated in the past 6 to 7 years. The deviation of the 5-year running mean from the linear warming is large and persistent. It implies an increase in the net climate forcing and Earth's energy imbalance, which drive global warming, end quote from Hansen and Sato. There was a similar bump, he says, in the heating in the 1980s, and that was caused by CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons, which not only damage the ozone layer, but they are fantastically powerful greenhouse gases. Pound per pound, CFCs have 10,000 times the heat-trapping ability of carbon dioxide. Fortunately, most production of CFCs was banned in the 1987 Montreal Protocol, and this gas does not last anywhere near as long as carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, CO2, can hang in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. Replacements for CFCs are also, sadly, strong global warming gases, but they're less likely to damage the ozone layer. We still have a major problem with refrigerants and climate change. Moving to the last 5 years, our fossil fuel emissions are many times greater than they were in the 1980s. Oil, gas, and coal use kept growing as globalized industry and consumption expanded around the world. Even so, Hansen says, the warming of the last few years, and 2020 in particular, cannot be explained by the continuing growth of emissions alone. Something else is adding to the heat. The authors say, quote, the greenhouse gas climate forcing growth rate has accelerated in the past decade, but not enough to account for the observed acceleration of the global warming rate, end quote. Well, now we come to a new understanding of how this works. Previously, various scientists and news articles declared there was a time lag somewhere between 10 to 20 years from the time greenhouse gases went into the air until the actual impact is felt. That is because the ocean can capture heat or energy and mix it down below the surface. In this new post, Hansen and Sato say, global warming is driven both by Earth's current energy imbalance and by the recent growth of net climate forcing. The most recent several years have the largest effect on current warming. Their modeling at NASA shows, quote, that about a third of the response is obtained within the first 5 years. The remaining two-thirds is recalcitrant or slow. That is important news for all of us. About a third of the climate impact from our industry, transportation, heating, and all that shows up within 5 years. The other two-thirds will mostly mix down into the ocean to reappear later this century and in many centuries to come. If we were comfortable that the worst impacts would show up long after we are dead, think again. Obviously, each year's additional greenhouse gases are added to the previous year, and all previous years. Before that, going right back to the beginning of the Industrial Age, the cumulative carbon is not the exact same molecules from our stacks and tailpipes. Okay, it goes through a carbon cycle that includes plants, but the totals grow and grow. The parts per million level of CO2 in the atmosphere was recently measured at 417 parts per million. It has gotten higher than that even for a short period. The last time Earth was at 350 parts per million carbon dioxide was around 1985. That is the level James Hansen says is required to have ice at the poles and the climate that you and I evolved in. Somehow, we need to go back to 350 parts per million or less, but that is another whole topic.
Radio EcoShock.
Hansen and Sato continue. We know that if only forcing changes were the greenhouse gases and the sun, there would be no acceleration of global warming in the past 5 years. Indeed, there should be a decrease in the warming rate. The real-world acceleration tells us that there must be another forcing, which is unmeasured. There is only one good candidate, aerosols. Although NASA chose not to measure the aerosol climate forcing, some aerosol models suggest that global aerosol amount has decreased in the past decade, so he's saying the pollution has gone down. They are not saying that the world should have cooled in the last 5 years. The warming, of course, is because we continue to push more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But the rate of warming is even greater than expected from those emissions. Why? They conclude the only explanation is we have less pollution. There are various ways pollution can cool the planet. Smog can block sun from reaching the surface of the land or the ocean. Burning fossil fuels also releases tiny specks of sulfates, which can reflect the sun's energy back into space before it reaches us. In the early years of this century, great clouds of smog, mostly from coal, but also oil and even cooking, added a darkening layer over massive areas of North India and China. The pollution is still killing countless millions of people around the world, but there has been a lot of public pressure on governments to clean up the air. In North America and Europe, there is still a lot of pollution, but far less than in the 1970s when the Clean Air Act and similar legislation in Europe slashed pollution rates. The killer clouds of smog hanging over major Chinese cities in recent decades was legendary, but in recent years, China has taken very aggressive action to clean up the air. Coal burning is on the decline worldwide, reducing pollution greatly. Solar, wind, and electric cars are beginning to decrease airborne particles, which scientists call aerosols. In medieval stories, Dr. Faustus makes a bargain with the devil called Mephistopheles. He sells his soul, in a few years' time, to get answers about the universe now. Hansen and Sato say, quote, "The Faustian bargain, humans have enjoyed the fruits of the Industrial Revolution and avoided a large cost in climate change, as aerosol cooling has mitigated greenhouse warming. Payment comes due when humanity realizes it cannot tolerate the further exponential growth of air pollution that would be needed for the continued mitigation of global warming," end quote. Here Hansen and Sato return to their case made over several years that aerosol cooling is much greater than estimates used in IPCC climate models. In science talk, all this is measured in watts per square meter, generally as solar energy. If you do not use metric measurements, a square meter is about 10.7 square feet. So picture the energy of a 1-watt light bulb illuminating that space. That's a rough way to picture watts per square meter. Sometimes scientists also use the joule, a measurement of energy named after the English physicist James Prescott Joule.
Radio EcoShock.
It is not much energy, but if you increase the solar power reaching the Earth just a little and spread that over the entire surface of the globe, that becomes a massive amount of energy. It is measured in zeta joules, ZJ, which is the energy of sextillion joules, or 10 with 21 zeros after it. So how much has the aerosol pollution cooled the planet? Recent IPCC reports and climate models assume aerosols cooled the planet in the range of about 0.5 watts per square meter up to 1 watt per square meter. Of course, we want to know, well, what does that mean? According to Richard Schiffman at the Yale blog E360, he says, an international team of scientists has quantified that cooling effect, saying the Earth would be 0.5 to 1.1 degrees C, or 0.9 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer if that pollution were to suddenly disappear. So it looks like watts per square meter and temperature in centigrade are the same thing. Sadly, things are more complicated than that. For example, some calculate that if 3.5 watts per square meter more energy landed at the surface, Earth would warm by about 1.5 degrees C. We won't go into the many factors now. It's too complicated. There is a major paper just published in September 2020 with Hansen as a co-author, and it updates the essentials of climate change, and I hope to cover that soon. The important thing is, our pollution has been cooling us. The general run of science leading to reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says we have been cooled by somewhere between half a degree to just over 1 degree C. Now that's pretty amazing. If 1 degree C, could smog have cooled us as much as fossil fuels have warmed us? That seems unlikely to me. If you think it through, though, our situation is very serious. Even with that blanket of reflective smog, we have warmed the Earth by at least 1 degree C, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And the results? They're already grim, with almost half of Australia's broadleaf forest burning last year alone. And the heat waves, the hurricanes, you know the rest. If we cleaned up pollution completely, this planet would already be past the 2 degrees of warming, which we supposedly can tolerate, according to the officials. Pollution is being reduced, and it can dribble down to almost nothing if world industry and transportation were to suddenly shut down. That just happened, of course, in many countries, due to the pandemic. It could also occur in an economic meltdown or widespread grid failures. Maybe the aerosol problem turns out worse than the IPCC science community think. Hansen and Sato say the IPCC and other climate modelers have gravely underestimated the protection we had from pollution. In 2011, Hansen and other authors published a paper showing aerosol cooling was really about 1.6 watts per square meter, one-third higher than the standard assessment. It might be possible that if pollution stops and is rained out in a few weeks, planet Earth could already be approaching 3 degrees C of global warming. We may already be in a disastrous state, but the impacts have been hidden by aerosol pollution. We don't know for sure. Hansen and Sato say of this, our Faustian bargain with aerosols, they say, is it important? Yes. It means that the little blip of extra warming that we got in the last 5 years is only a down payment on the penalty that young people will pay for our Faustian bargain. Mephistopheles is coming, but it is our grandchildren that he will be dragging off. And that comes from Hansen and Sato. Hansen, the longtime NASA space expert, says we need to settle this big difference about the cooling power of aerosols. He describes a new satellite monitoring program to find out for sure. Considering our civilization is at stake, it is shocking that we don't know.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Maybe the spurt of warming in 2020 was just because we added so many more greenhouse gases. Hansen and Sato investigate that. They agree there is a decline in the increase of greenhouse gases in 2020, I think, due to the pandemic. The authors predict the increase of warming gases will drop down a little bit more in 2021 due to the strong La Niña now underway. However, methane is shooting up, presumably as a result of fracking, they say, increased venting at oil wells, and global warming feedbacks from warming wetlands and permafrost, end quote. Because methane, known chemically as CH4, is anywhere from 10 to 100 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, it is possible the increase in methane has compensated for lower carbon dioxide emissions during the pandemic, keeping us on a steep track upward with more warming gases. The other major warming gas is nitrous oxide, often from agriculture. Those emissions are growing slowly, these two authors say. They conclude, slower CO2 growth offsets increased methane and nitrous oxide growth, so our estimate for the added greenhouse gas forcing in 2020 is essentially the same as in 2019. But could it just be all from a change in the sun? Quoting from Hansen and Sato, one more thing. Remember the cry of the climate deniers? Many of them were counting on the sun to go into a new, prolonged Maunder minimum. That was possible, although the resulting negative climate forcing, or cooling, would be small compared with the human-made greenhouse gas forcing. It turns out that, on the contrary, we are now entering the next solar cycle. Solar minimum was late 2019. The uptick in the irradiance is small so far, but the predictions from some solar models are that the coming maximum will be a strong one. The impact of solar irradiance on global temperature lags solar irradiance by 1 to 2 years, so we're still at the point where we're getting maximum cooling from the solar cycle. Maximum added push of the solar cycle towards a warmer climate will be in the mid-decade, i.e., in about 5 years. Global temperature prognostication, 2021 will be cooler than 2020 because of the lagged effect of the current strong La Niña. When the next global El Niño occurs, perhaps around mid-decade, hang on to your hat, global emissions of GHGs had better be trending down by then. So say James Hansen and Makiko Sato in their paper, actually their blog post, released in December 2020. And they're saying that 2021 might be a bit cooler than 2020, but because of our continuous addition of greenhouse gases, it could still be among the top 5 hottest climate years ever. As our recent guests Kevin Trenberth and Will Steffen told us, human-made greenhouse gases have overwhelmed La Niña and El Niño to become the driving force of climate change. Public demand to breathe cleaner air is very strong. We have the technology to do it. There is much more warming coming as we remove the cooling layer of smog, and that warming could come much faster than increases from our fossil fuel burning because those aerosols don't stay in the air for very long. Add in some strong extra solar heat as part of the natural cycle of the sun, and the inevitable El Niño that will come. And yes, some year around 2025 could be the breaking point. Then coping with climate change will be the number one struggle for all governments, for all economies, and for all of us. The climate action needed to happen during the 1990s if we wanted to stay around 350 parts per million. Hansen estimates it will cost trillions and trillions of dollars, and it will probably take years and years if we can ever get back to around 350 parts per million and the world that we need. At this late date, we have the climate emergency. That is not just a phrase or an activist gimmick. The climate emergency will kill millions more people than the epidemic ever will. An unstable climate will derail all our lives, making everything harder or even impossible. The single largest threat to everything we love and that we need is simply climate change. If we do not solve that in time, I fear nothing else will matter. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. Please check out my blog at ecoshock.org, where I have a lot more information for you, and all my past radio programs are there for free.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
Coming up next week, all new interviews with super scientists Michael Mann and Ben Santer. Be sure to tune in. The United Nations tells us millions of people die prematurely every year because of air pollution. We don't know exactly how many, because some deaths in India and South America are not reported, and mortalities all over the world put heart attack or other causes of death on that death certificate, even during and right after major pollution events. Millions more struggle to breathe with asthma and other debilitating illnesses either caused or made worse by air pollution. We know that smog cools the planet like a kind of unintentional geoengineering. It hides our actual climate state. So, is it safe to clean up air pollution? Should we do it? Scientists agree industrial pollution in the atmosphere does hide some global warming expected from our emissions, but how much? Respected scientists like James Hansen have suggested that a degree Celsius or more is in the pipeline due to pollution, called aerosols in science. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has a wide range of possible impacts of aerosols, but they recently dropped their lowest estimates. The whole subject is one of the most difficult in science because it involves swirls of widely varying materials in the atmosphere, all unevenly distributed around the globe. The aerosols also interact with one of the last frontiers of science, the activities of clouds. In my Radio EcoShock show at the end of December 2020, we heard the case for a strong climate masking due to aerosols. That was from James Hansen and Makiko Sato in their new post, Global Warming Acceleration. Now let us get a different point of view in my Radio EcoShock interview, broadcast September 17, 2015, with a top German-American scientist.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Our guest, Professor Bjorn Stevens, is a director at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology, where he leads the Atmosphere in the Earth System Department. He's also a professor at the University of Hamburg. Dr. Stevens was previously at the University of California in Los Angeles. Although born in Germany, he's an American citizen. He was educated in the United States. Bjorn Stevens is one of the world authorities on clouds and climate change. He's the lead author of a new paper on the limits of aerosol impacts on global warming, and that paper has already stirred up controversy, including among climate skeptics. Bjorn Stevens, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The public knows so little about this scientific discussion, except when it's called global dimming. Is that an appropriate label?
Well, I'm not even sure people know that much about global dimming. There is this concept of global dimming and global brightening, which is normally associated with this regional pattern over Europe that happened in the 1950s and 1980s, where it seemed to be surface measurements of radiation were somewhat dimmed and then got brighter after the 1980s. And that's usually attributed to the atmospheric aerosol and human emissions of aerosols and aerosols precursors. Even that's a bit controversial to what extent that's due to aerosol processes. So when you speak about global dimming, it often gets convolved with this regional dimming and brightening. So it's even a bit unclear to me how much people really understand the aerosol issue, even when it's called global dimming.
Well, maybe we should back up a bit. What is an aerosol? How would you describe them?
Well, there's the formal definition. Formally, an aerosol is just a dispersion of one phase of matter in another. So an example would be, for instance, gas bubbles. Gas phase suspended in liquid. So that would be an example of aerosol. When a wave breaks and you have lots of gas bubbles floating around in the water, that's an aerosol. Or if you have liquid phase suspended in the air, which is what a cloud is, that's also an aerosol. Or ice particles, which is a solid phase, that's also an aerosol. But usually, as atmospheric scientists, when we think of aerosols, we normally think of the non-water particulate matter suspended in the atmosphere, the very small submicron particles that are everywhere in the air. The atmosphere is full of particulates, and many of these are actually quite natural, as anyone who has seen a dust storm or tasted the salt in a sea breeze or sneezed in a field of hay can attest.
So you've entered into quite a debate with your new paper. Please tell us the title of the paper and give us an introduction as to why you did this study.
Well, the paper is called Rethinking the Lower Bound on Aerosol Radiative Forcing, and it arose out of an argument I had with some authors of a very influential study from the early 1990s, which I believe greatly overstated the magnitude of aerosol forcing. So I was trying to convince them in a series of emails what I thought was flawed in their original reasoning. And at some point I thought, well, maybe it's just better to write these ideas down in a paper and then they can be evaluated as part of the normal scientific process. And the argument has something to do what I believe there's a long tradition of overstating the magnitude of aerosol forcing. And it's a very easy trap to fall into, because if you look too narrowly at the subject, it's very easy to get lost in the details. And my paper was an attempt to step back a bit and explain why I think a large, at least in magnitude, aerosol radiative forcing really doesn't make physical sense.
And I'm told there are two approaches to calculating the cooling effect of human-made pollution. One is to try and add up all the known sources, from factories to burning fields in Africa. You took quite a different approach, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Rather than trying to estimate the aerosol forcing directly in what one might call a bottom-up approach, where you try to go to the smallest scale and add up all the little pieces and how they interact and estimate the uncertainty, I focused more on not the aerosol forcing itself, but on the bounds and the extent to which a given bound is consistent with our broader understanding of the climate system. And by a bound, I mean the question is, how big could the aerosol forcing be and still be consistent with other things we know about the climate system? A good example of a bound would be that if you had to make a physical measurement, say the diameter of a pipe, you might be uncertain in lots of things that you're doing, and you could estimate that uncertainty. And if you formally added up all that uncertainty, it's quite conceivable that you'd come up with an answer that says the pipe has a negative diameter, which of course makes no physical sense. So you know right away that the pipe has a diameter greater than zero. So that's an example of a bound. The diameter of the pipe has to be greater than zero. And for the aerosol forcing, I also focused on the bounds, and I said, well, how negative could an aerosol forcing be and still be consistent with the big picture? So this forced me to look at the big picture directly rather than trying to piece it together through the details.
An important part of your paper, it seems to me, depends on estimating the impacts of pollution in the first half of the 20th century. How could you possibly know about pollution in the 1930s or 1940s, for example?
Yeah, the paper actually outlines several different lines of argument for why I think the aerosol forcing is less negative than often assumed, and one of those is, as you said, it's about the importance of pollution in the first half of the 20th century. I assume that the global aerosol effect is proportional to that associated with anthropogenic SO2 or sulfur dioxide emissions. When we account for fossil fuel use, which is reasonably well known over the past 100 or 200 years, we can get a pretty good handle on SO2 emissions because we know the sulfur content of fuels. There's a long tradition, actually, of scaling aerosol forcing with anthropogenic SO2 emissions. In fact, that very early study that I was arguing with, which got me into this topic to begin with, did the same thing. So I go a bit further, actually, and I show in my study that this tradition of saying that the total aerosol forcing is proportional to the SO2 emissions is actually well supported by the much more complicated calculations which try to add up the different sources that happen regionally and over time.
I realize this is a huge question, but can you say that there are important differences between pollution in this new century compared with the aerosols created in the 1900s?
Well, an important difference is that it's not changing nearly as rapidly as it was 100 years ago. So at the beginning of the industrial era, we had a really explosion of human-related aerosol emissions. So if you look in the early part of the 20th century and you look at how SO2 increased sulfur dioxide emissions, it was enormous. When you look globally, there's actually very little evidence that there's been much change in the net anthropogenic emissions of aerosols over the last 40 years. People get very excited about regional changes. So you see, for instance, as China has developed over the past 10 or 15 years, you've seen an enormous increase, and people have all seen the pictures of smog over China. There's been an enormous increase in terms of aerosol emissions or aerosol precursor emissions over China. But at the same time, what you've seen is declining emissions of SO2 as Europe and North America have desulfurized their fuels. So you've seen big regional changes over the last 40 years. But globally, the big difference is that the aerosol forcing was changing a lot at the beginning of last century and really hasn't been changing very much over the past 40 years.
I'd like to turn to the difficult subject of equilibrium climate sensitivity, or ECS.
Bjorn Stevens, how can a non-scientist understand what this means?
Oh, it's actually a very simple idea, and that's its appeal. Maybe one analogy is to think of a pot of water on a camp stove. And imagine the water is not too hot, so it's not boiling, the flame's not too high. And, you know, if you have the flame really on a low temperature, then you'd be heating up the water, and it's kind of losing its heat to the air, so it's giving off steam. And it would kind of be at a constant temperature. If the flame's not too high, you might even be able to put your finger in the water without boiling it. Now, if you turn up the flame a little bit more, the water will get a bit hotter, and it'll keep going until it starts boiling. But in many ways, this question of, for a given increase in the flame, how hot does the water get, is very much the same idea of equilibrium climate sensitivity. For the pot of water, it might be better to think of, you know, what's the temperature of the water if you put the lid half on or three quarters on or fully on, because, you know, if you put a little bit of heat in the bottom of the pot and you have the lid fully on, the water will be hotter than if you had the lid fully off. That would be a bit like the case of greenhouse gases. So climate sensitivity is really just the simple attempt to ask, if you increase the forcing, the heating of the planet, or decrease its ability to cool, how much warmer will it get? And formally, it comes to this question. We like to phrase it as equilibrium climate sensitivity. We like to think of a particular scenario that's especially easy. We say, just imagine you double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. How much warmer on average would the near surface air temperatures be? And that number is the equilibrium climate sensitivity.
Do we have an answer to that, a firm answer?
Well, we don't have the answer in the form of one number, like 4 or 4.2, but we have a range of values which have stood the test of time for what that number, what we think that number is. And it's a range that goes between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius. And a lot of the game over the last years has been to see if we can actually narrow the range in that estimate, because it's pretty broad.
So good. How does your work on the limits of aerosol forcing impact our understanding of climate sensitivity?
Well, it's a bit of a distance from my work to climate sensitivity, and they really come together, because if one attempts to estimate the climate sensitivity by the historical record of temperature changes and the historical record of radiative forcing, then the aerosol forcing is an important part of that calculation. And if you estimate things in that way, what my research would suggest is that the climate is a little bit less sensitive than it would have been if the aerosol forcing had been much larger in magnitude.
Why do you think climate skeptics and skeptical scientists like Nick Lewis and Judith Curry are among the first to write extensively about your new paper?
Well, I don't know. I find it a bit dangerous to speculate about people's motivations. And to be honest, I really don't pay much attention to the blogosphere. If anything, I make a conscious attempt to ignore it. I certainly can understand why someone who is of the opinion that the public was overly alarmed by the risk of warmings might want to draw attention to my paper, because it's going to help you make one or the other argument. And likewise, if someone was of the opinion that the public is not sufficiently alarmed about the risks of warming, they might find undue attention on my paper as a bit counterproductive. But I don't know, as a scientist, I think we have an obligation to clearly state what we believe to be true, irrespective of how we perceive that might be used by others.
Does your view of a lower impact from aerosol pollution change the models and conclusions in the reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Well, my work suggests that models are overstating the impact of the anthropogenic aerosol. And maybe that's not so surprising. Modeling the atmospheric aerosol is really fantastically difficult. It's loosely based on basic principles and not very well constrained by data. So I don't think anyone finds it surprising that attempts to model such the detailed life cycle of something as complex and as poorly understood as the aerosol could be off, and off by a large factor. I was part of the IPCC assessment, of the last assessment, the fifth assessment, and I think based on the information available at that time, the assessment was a reasonable one. My study brings new arguments to the table, and I would expect or hope that these will be reflected in the next assessment.
And you did give a talk at Ringberg last spring, which began with the title, Some Not Yet Entirely Convincing Reasons Why This Is So. Does this suggest you think the question is still open for debate?
Let's see if I answer that properly. I think ECS, or equilibrium climate sensitivity, of less than 2 degrees is pretty hard to reconcile with what we know about the paleo record, or the behavior of the Earth through the course of ice ages, or even over longer time periods. And an equilibrium climate sensitivity over 3.5 is pretty hard to reconcile with the instrumental record. There's additional evidence that points to why an ECS, say less than 2 or greater than 3.5 or 4, should be seen as unlikely. But this is an ongoing argument. It's ongoing research, some of which is at the heart of the things we're doing here at my laboratory in Hamburg.
Some critics say you've dismissed the important role played by black carbon. What do you say about that?
Well, the issue certainly came up in the reviews of my paper. And black carbon, like many aspects of the aerosol, is often used as a joker, which allows people to play it any way that one finds convenient. So, for instance, colleagues have argued that I neglected the large increase in black carbon in the middle of the last century. So one of the arguments I actually gave was that the temperature increase in the middle of last century is hard to explain if you assume a large aerosol cooling. And they say, you forgot black carbon in the middle part of the last century. And then other colleagues come and they say, well, actually, the black carbon was all happening in the latter part of the century. There's many people who argue that black carbon is playing a disproportionate role in the forcing in the present period. So there's been people arguing that black carbon is contributing substantial warming to the climate in the present. Yet some of the same scientists then actually say that the lack of a surface warming signal in the past 15 years, or the modesty of the surface warming signal in the past 15 years, is because of the aerosol, and the implication being black carbon is not playing a role. So throughout all of this, I think it's important to realize that the aerosol is a very complex component of the climate system. And it's easy to think of reasons why, you know, it might be behaving in a particularly unusual way, which can explain this or that fact about the climate system. I tended to take a more conservative approach. And I think when you look at it from the aerosol point of view, the reality is that the aerosol forcing is, if it's important, it was far more important in the last century when CO2 wasn't playing such an important role. And I think as aerosol science matures, it will be increasingly apparent to people that to the extent we want to speculate about the role of the aerosol in future climate, the role of black carbon now, the role of it in the past, really depends on our ability to robustly demonstrate what was it about the 20th century that was different because we had such a large aerosol forcing. No one would dispute in the 20th century aerosol was a major player in the forcing of the climate system. In the 21st century, it won't be. CO2 keeps chugging away, more and more CO2. Aerosol hasn't really changed in 40 years. And so if you're looking for an aerosol signal, say from black carbon or from sulfate or from other components of aerosol, the real place to look is in the 20th century, not in the 21st century.
And it seems your work began with a global picture, as you say, and global data. Is that not a limitation when it comes to determining the regional impacts of aerosol pollution in places like China or North India?
It depends a bit what you mean by regional impacts. Certainly, it's a limitation if you're interested in regional health impacts. But if you're interested in the effect on global warming, the global signal, then the scientific question is the effect of the aerosol linear in the emissions? And if it's linear in the emissions, the global effect, then it's not a limitation of neglecting these sort of regional hotspots. And aerosol interactions with radiation are largely linear. That's the basis of most theoretical treatments of it. When you think about aerosol cloud interactions, those are nonlinear, and I accounted for these nonlinearities. Whether I do so adequately is something that we're presently testing in my laboratory. One aspect that I'm quite fond of in my study is that the assumptions I make are all very transparent and very testable, and I think that's really the key to advancing the science. In the end, it's less important to be right or wrong or to get the right number than it is to advance constructive scientific arguments and really have ideas that other people can check and follow up on. And when it comes to the pattern of aerosol forcing, I think my study was quite clear in how one can do that.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest from Hamburg, Germany, is atmospheric scientist Bjorn Stevens. We're discussing his new paper, Rethinking the Lower Bound on Aerosol Radiative Forcing, and what that means for us all. Now, the IPCC has acknowledged trying to calculate cloud activity is one of the most difficult problems of all. How does aerosol pollution interact with clouds? You'd mentioned that before. How does that affect the cooling or lack of cooling?
Well, the main effect is probably to make the clouds a bit brighter because the cloud droplets form on more particles, on an average, are a bit smaller. It gives them a bit more surface area, and they scatter more radiation. The next order effect we generally think is it makes the clouds mix a bit more efficiently so that they contain a bit less condensate. That tends to offset the other effect, and it's a bit of a lesson there. As research over the past 30 years is really, I think, one of the things that's clearly come out of the research is that aerosol interactions with clouds happen in many, many different ways. But they happen in opposing ways. Many of them act to offset or buffer one another. Fundamentally, it's really important to remember that clouds form in response to atmospheric circulations, and the circulations are driven by the interaction of radiation with things like water vapor. And the role of the aerosol in explaining cloud formation is interesting, often fascinating, but really secondary.
Do you think there will ever be a cloud theory which could predict their behavior, a kind of solid theory of clouds?
Oh, I would say we already have some very compelling theories that have helped us understand a great deal about clouds. For the most part, we know the basic equations for clouds. When we do have uncertainties on the basic level, they come from a poor understanding of ice processes and difficulty in developing an aggregated view of clouds. So we have the basic equations to describe clouds, modulo some understanding of ice processes. We have a real difficult time when it talks about the aggregated behavior of the clouds, if you like, the sociology of clouds. But here I see a lot of prospects for a bright future for cloud and water vapor research, both because of the capacity we have for field measurements, advances in satellite remote sensing of clouds, especially three-dimensionally. There's a range of satellite sensors that can probe through the depth of the atmosphere and tell you a lot about the morphology of clouds and their placement through the vertical depth of the atmosphere. And advances in computing allow us to use the basic equations, which we know reasonably well and understand, to explore what I was calling this sociology of clouds, the aggregated behavior of fields of clouds. So I'm quite optimistic that we can begin bringing together a lot of the fairly well-developed theoretical ideas we have of clouds into a more consistent global picture.
From my perspective, Bjorn, if your research results become widely accepted and proven true, this could be good news. I say that because many of us, including scientists like James Lovelock and James Hansen, feared that cleaning up air pollution could unleash warming rather quickly, almost like a climate punch. But maybe we have less to worry about if we clean up.
Yeah, indeed. I've been saying for a while we have nothing to fear from clean air.
Right, and we could possibly save millions of lives if we can do it. So is there a test that would vindicate your assessment that aerosol forcing may be much lower than we thought, or do you think it's already proven?
Well, mathematicians and lawyers are probably the only class of individuals that prove things. Scientists develop narratives, and we argue about them. And at some point, the arguments become so convincing that in the absence of new information, we spend our time arguing about other things. So, for instance, we don't spend much time arguing about evolution anymore, or we don't really worry about whether or not the sun's at the center of the solar system. And I think most scientists really don't argue very much about whether increasing level of CO2 are due to humans and whether or not that causes warming. And so at most I can hope we'll spend a little less time arguing about the importance of the atmospheric aerosol. But that may take some time.
You know, I'm struggling to picture how we could move this important discussion out of the scientific conference halls and journals and into the public mind. Do you have ideas how we could frame this debate so that anyone with a high school education could understand it, or is it too soon for that?
I'm not sure. I think regardless of how one looks at the debate, it's very important to understand that the question of aerosol forcing is really a question of, as I said before, it's a question of the 20th century, not the 21st century. When thinking about research priorities for the 21st century, what's changing and what's happening is that the Earth is warming and CO2 concentrations are increasing. And we don't really understand what that means in some detail. We know that the Earth's going to get warmer, but with a warmer world, do the rain bands shift? Do the storms intensify? These are the sorts of questions which I think we increasingly need to focus on. And we need to think about how we can measure the changes that are happening to the Earth system as we go through this unprecedented change in the composition of the atmosphere, as we increase the amount of CO2, as the Earth warms. Are we measuring the flows of energy through the system adequately? And the answer is no. Are we keeping track of the ocean's heat content adequately? And the answer is probably no. And are we keeping our eye on the prize in terms of what is the distribution of clouds and water vapor in the atmosphere and the structure of circulation systems, which we're arguing may be changing? And there's a real danger that rather than looking at these basic fundamental aspects of the Earth system as it warms, we'll turn ourselves to an ever more detailed view, what I would call an embroidery of the climate system, because those are new and interesting and fascinating things, but they're probably not the most important things.
So you would say that aerosols are perhaps not what leaders at the Paris Climate Talk should be talking about?
Well, certainly, cleaning up the aerosol is hugely important for human health, and they shouldn't worry about cleaning up the air. So I would hope that would be the simplest of things that they could do, because I really see very little repercussion from cleaning up the air in terms of the global climate system. And huge benefits, as far as I understand it, are likely to follow for human health. So maybe that's one thing they should be talking about in that sense. They should, of course, be talking about CO2, because every molecule of CO2 we don't emit today does, I like to say, 1,000 years of good. And another thing that they should be talking about is that as we try to adapt, which we'll have to do in part, regardless of how much we mitigate against CO2 emissions, how we adapt is far more a question of basic research than most policymakers, and I would venture even scientists, appreciate. Forsaking the basic science or trying to tie it too closely to the perceived needs of the policy communities is, I would say, grossly negligent of future generations, because the climate's changing. And one thing we know is we're going to have surprises. And the best way to prepare society for surprises is to give scientists the creative potential to think about the things that they wouldn't ordinarily think about if they were following the short-term needs of the policy community. And that's what you call curiosity-driven or basic research. And I think we're not leaving enough space for that in climate science.
As we finish up, Bjorn, is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I would like to say science is fun. It's great fun. There's huge challenges facing climate sciences, and most of these are related to understanding how the atmospheric circulation will respond to warming. I think we should stop, well, most of us actually have stopped posing the question as to whether the Earth will warm because of increasing CO2. The real question is what happens when it warms. So we've spent most of the last 40 years asking whether the Earth will warm and to what extent humans are responsible. We know the answers. The answer is yes and yes. So the real interesting and fun questions scientifically are how Earth's circulation systems respond to this warming. And the more we look at it, the more we appreciate that clouds are at the heart of this puzzle. So it's a great time to be interested in clouds and circulation and atmospheric science.
We've been talking with the director of the prestigious Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany, Bjorn Stevens. Dr. Stevens, it's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I've been covering the worry about pollution and global warming since my very first Radio EcoShock broadcast on CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. This is from that opening show on September 17th, 2006.
Strangely, Lovelock says that pollution itself has helped deflect some of the sun's heat in a phenomenon called global dimming, but, quote, "This global dimming is a transient and could disappear in a few days, like the smoke that it is, leaving us fully exposed to the heat of the global greenhouse. We are in a fool's climate, accidentally kept cool by smoke."
Here is another blast from the past, Radio EcoShock, September 2006.
Aside from mere humans, the giant flume of civilization's dust is bending the climate in strange ways for all living creatures. Dr. Ramanthan was able to show the Asian brown cloud lowered rainfall. It was one cause of recent droughts and mistimed or missing monsoons on the Indian subcontinent. The accumulation of soot, chemicals, and dust in the atmosphere appear to reduce the formation of raindrops. Blowing over the Pacific, this atmospheric river of pollution may be contributing to the drought in the former Amazon rainforest and even the growing deserts of Africa and China. At the same time, the brown clouds have shaded the earth, hiding some of the impact of accumulating greenhouse gases. Ramathan told science writer Regina Nuzzo, "By sheer dumb luck, we are adding particles that are trapping sunlight and cooling the planet." He compared it to a mask. And if that pollution is removed, the climate may suddenly rise to the real levels of warming gases in the atmosphere. Quote, "Many of us, including myself, are concerned we could see a huge acceleration of global warming if we unmask the beast." Lots of scientists have this lurking nightmare when they turn off the soothing lull of social chatter. Yet air pollution can't be used as a tool to fight climate change. Millions are being killed by it. Just like you, my friend, my own health is being damaged daily by air particles I can't see entering my lungs and arteries. Now pardon me while I turn up my HEPA air filter. Meanwhile, the brown mask of pollution is falling away. The Western world has slowly reduced smog. The former Soviet Union, a champion of dirty production, has dropped its smokestack emissions along with its faltering economy. In this new century, scientists are finding the sunlight is measurably returning in strength, regaining power lost to smog in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Will the unabated growth of dirty industry in Asia produce a temporary climate peace? Not likely. Particles like soot and sulfates only last a few weeks in the atmosphere. They can be washed out by rain. Meanwhile, carbon builds inexorably in the atmosphere year by year. Carbon can last 100 years. As long as we keep polluting with fossil fuels and other greenhouse gases, we can only lose the game. When the feeble clouds wash away, the blanket of unnatural gases will trap the sun's power inside the Earth's greenhouse. That's the end of the race. Unless we turn away, and soon. This report is from Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org. It's free, non-stop information about your planet, so tune in.
What do we do when the trees are gone? What do we do with this hole in the sky? And the pollution in the air, what I'm gonna do, what I'm gonna do, you and I.
One more clip from my first Radio EcoShock show in September 2006.
We get a more scientific explanation from livescience.com for January 20th. Quote, "Smog is blocking sunlight in China and making much of the country significantly darker than it was half a century ago. Using nearly 500 instruments spread throughout the country that record the amount of sunlight reaching the ground, researchers found that solar radiation has decreased by about 2% per decade since 1954. The country is roughly 10% darker on average than it was 50 years ago. Imagine, humans have actually made the sky go dark. And it isn't more clouds. In fact, researcher Yun Yan from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory reports cloud cover has decreased in China. So the change comes from fossil fuel emissions, which increased ninefold in the last century. That smoggy coal haze is absorbing and deflecting sunlight. You can find that study online in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. And America itself doesn't smell so sweet either.
This is a NASA photograph of the Northeast, and I want to point out that this white stuff here is clouds, but this stuff underneath it is not a cloud. That's a fine particle aerosol haze. Those are particles. East coast of North America is blanketed with particles in the summer. And in the summer, almost half of those particles are sulfates. They're long-range transported particles from the power plants in the Midwest. And you don't need an air pollution monitor. You can see it from space.
Join us next week on Radio EcoShock as we kick off the new year of 2021. It's got to be better than the last one. Two of America's most famous climate scientists, Michael Mann and Ben Sander, talk climate, their latest work, and recovering from science denial. Meanwhile, feel free to binge on all our past programs absolutely free at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Stay safe, and thank you for listening.